This is a second part of the interview that Tim O'Brien made with Sir Bernard Lovell. For the rest of this interview and the full podcast, please visit us at www.jodcast.net.
And at the end of the war, I mean, you came back to Manchester University, didn't you? What brought you from Manchester to this place, to Jodrell Bank?
Well, I had been involved with entirely different things during the war. And I was not sure what I would do, because they wanted me to stay in the research establishment, and I was offered jobs elsewhere. But Blackett, then I kept in close touch with Blackett during the war. And he had, at the end of the war, became the director of naval operational research in the Navy, in the Admiralty. And he told me he was returning to Manchester. Well, I knew that. I just wanted to come and work with Blackett again. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came back to Manchester. I incidentally, not that it mattered in those days, but at half the salary I was getting in in the war machine.
I mean, you were back in the centre of Manchester, presumably, then, were you? How did you end up here?
Oh, well, I went back to the university, to the lab I was working in 6 years earlier, and there was my cloud chamber covered with a dust sheet. So I ripped off the dust sheet and started trying to get the cloud chamber working again. And I wanted a screwdriver. So I went to the lab steward and said, please, can I have a screwdriver? And he said, we don't have any money to buy a screwdriver. A few weeks earlier, you know, if I could pick up the telephone and say, look here, I want six Lancaster bombers. So anyhow, I was just young enough to survive that, you know, quite desperate recollection. Mm-hmm. Well, after a couple of days, Blackett suddenly appeared. And he said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm trying to get this thing to work again, but it's quite difficult. And he said, oh, I thought you were going to try a new technique for studying these high-energy particles. And so I put the cover over the cloud chamber again and went into the library and found some notes and a paper that Blackett and I had written about this possibility of using what I might call radar to study these very high-energy particles. I first of all thought of the possibility of using one of the giant chain home stations, but they weren't on the right frequency. Now, during the war, I'd been working on something entirely different, on a very high frequency or centimeter radar, and the calculation showed that I wanted a fairly long wavelength to study these particles. And I knew a person called J.S. Hay, who was working at West Byfleet with the Army Operational Research Group. And I said, look, could I borrow some of your 4-meter radar equipment? And he said, yes, of course. You know, it was all being thrown away in those days. And I had been released in the summer of 1945, and had returned to Manchester about the total end of the war. And so Hay sent up three trailers of radar equipment, which had been used in the defence of London against the AK-AK guns. They consisted of a receiver cabin, a hefty transmitter in another cabin, and a diesel generator to generate the power. So with the help of the Army, who brought it up, I erected this in the university premises, to the consternation, I might say, everybody in the university. They'd never seen any big scientific equipment before. It was hopeless. The cathode ray tube was submerged in interference. Believe it or not, in those days, electric trams were running along Oxford Road, and moreover, they were direct current. Mm-hmm. Amazing to think of now. Naturally, they generate enormous sparks. So Black had suggested that I try to find if the university had any grounds outside of Manchester. And he pointed out a man called Sansom in the staff room who... first of all, he sent me to High Lee. Well, High Lee was hopeless because there were already high voltage lines run across. And I went there on a wet day, and it was a sizzle of the sparks. I returned immediately. And it was then that I was directed to this man, Sanson, who was a botanist. And it turned out that he was responsible for a place called Jodrell Bank, where the university... a botanic apartment had about 10 acres of land on which they had planted a lot of trees and so on, and there was a piece of good luck. Sanson seemed to be the only man in the university who was interested in this massive radar equipment I brought back, and he turned out, when he found out that I was very interested in the shrubs and trees he planted here, that cemented a very close agreement between us. So I had permission to bring this radar equipment to Jodrell Bank for 2 weeks only, in December, mid-December of 1945. And I was alone. The army left me. They put up the equipment. I was alone. And I had to get power. I couldn't turn the handle of the diesel generator. And when I eventually turned it, it wouldn't spark. And I discovered that the local farmer knew all about engines, a man called Moston. Mm-hmm. So... He helped me dismantle the thing and found out that the fuel pipes were blocked with ice. And so we started up the generator, and that's how we generated power. Mm-hmm. Well, I soon got echoes, but there were too many of them. And they obviously weren't from the high-energy cosmic ray showers, so there were too many echoes. And so I consulted Hay, who sent me a very secret document. He had been given the job of... trying to detect the V2 rockets, which were then being, which then harassing London, and he, it turned out that he was giving a lot of warnings of the approach of V2 rockets when none arrived, and we knew from agents, and he knew from agents that none had been rated, and it turned out that he himself had then, because of this, had looked into the literature, and he'd found out that. There were two American scientists, Schaefer and Goodall, who before the war had also observed echoes and had suggested that they might be due to meteor trails, ionized meteors coming into the upper atmosphere, burning up and leaving an ionized trail. So that's how I started on the radar observation of meteors at Jodrell Bank. Mm. Now... why wasn't I called back after 2 weeks? You see, the Vice Chancellor, Lord Stafford, he ruled that. First of all, he did not think quite reasonably that those of us who'd been at war for 6 years dealing with massive equipment would ever be able to come back to a university and teach and do research. A very reasonable doubt, if I might say so. So he ruled that, yes, I could take this equipment to Jodrell, but only for 2 weeks, and then I must return to the university campus and get on with an appointment there. Well, then another of these fortunate incidents happened. They forgot that I was in Jodrell. The reason Blackett forgot I was at Jodrell was that he had been a member of the very distinguished team of scientists who were to advise the cabinet, or advise the Prime Minister, it was then Attlee's government, about British participation or development into atomic bombs and so on. Well, of course, Cockcroft and there's they sent in a positive report to the inner cabinet. On the contrary, Blackett sent in a minority report arguing that the country could not afford to do this and various political reasons for not doing so. I learned later on when I read the two books by Margaret Gowing on the history of atomic energy and development in Great Britain, the story then of how the Prime Minister and the Chiefs of Staff just scrawled across Blackett's report, this man that may be a distinguished science, he knows nothing about military matters, you see. And he'd just been awarded the Legion of Honor or something in America for advising them on military tactics. And Blackett became naturally very angry, and he proceeded to write his famous book on the military and political consequences of atomic energy, which he contradicted all that Great Britain was doing and all that America was doing, and he was completely out on a limb, and he was forbidden to go to America. And on one occasion, he force-landed there on the way to Canada and was, in fact, in prison for a night or two. So naturally, he couldn't... He completely forgotten about a young man called Lowell who he'd last seen... Well, I don't think he'd ever been to Jodrell Bank in those days.
So
well, the end of that story, if I could just complete it, is by the time... Blackett had regained his composure and looked around his staff and thought, well, incredible, I saw they had a fellow called Lovell here, where is he? And then he came out to Jodrell, and by that time we were getting some quite interesting results. And one thing, you know, Blackett was fascinated about everything to do with the universe. And so that's how I'm still here.
Yeah. So what led you to build this, I mean, this giant telescope is out here now. What was it that sort of eventually led you to construct this?
The primarily, I discovered that I had omitted in a paper I'd written with Blackett, I had omitted a figure of what's called the damping effect of the which seriously affected the amount of the reflection one got from meteor from the cosmic ray energy which I was looking for. Well, we were at the limits of what we could do by getting more powerful transmitter. I needed a thousand times more sensitivity than I had with this radar, and the only way to get it was to build a big aerial. Well, I had one or two people working for me then, including John Clegg, who had been not in my group during the war, but he had been in TRE, and he was an expert on aerials. And we started to build a very big broadside array with a lot of scaffolding tubes. And then we really had to give up. We got to a height where we felt it was too dangerous to go any further. And then he had the brilliant idea of building a paraboloid. And so we built... I'm afraid it's no longer existing. The Mark II telescope is where it was. We built out of scaffolding poles and wire what turned out to be the biggest radio telescope ever built. Mm-hmm. It was 218 feet in diameter, and the focus was 126 feet above the ground on a steel pole. Mm-hmm. Now, how did I get the steel pole? Well, the answer again is that one day Blackett brought a member of the Department of Scientific Industrial Research to see what was going on at Jodrell. And this man, and he said, well, what are you doing? And I told him, and I said, well, I want some money to buy a steel pole. And he said, well, look here, this is exactly what my department would like to help with. So I got £1,000 to buy the steel pole. Now, that turned out to be important in another way. And that's how we started here. Now, I'm talking about now about 1948, 1949. That we called it a transit telescope because the beam we could divert the beam a few degrees by tilting the mast. Otherwise, it just swept quite a narrow beam. As the Earth rotated, it swept quite a narrow beam across the sky. And fortunately, you know, the one of the very important nebulae was on the edge of the beam, which turned out to be very vital at a different stage. I did try that transmitter as a radar instrument, mm-hmm. But soon gave up because we were then becoming absolutely fascinated by this entirely new science. Well, it's not a science then, of cosmic radio emission. Mm. You see, not cosmic rays, but real particles of Earth. The simultaneity of the name is perhaps rather unfortunate, but nevertheless, we now call it the radio emission from space, discovered by Jansky.
Radio astronomy. The
name radio astronomy was not then known, but it's reported, I think, in fact, that I first used the name in an article I wrote for the Manchester Guardian, and someone said that Palsy had also used it in Australia. So that's how we began the science of radio astronomy, and everything was new. Almost nothing was known about it then, apart from the results of Jansky and Raeber. It was not at all. It was not known, for example, that the radio emissions came from outside the local Milky Way system. And that is how I had the idea of the telescope, which is outside now, for two reasons. One was to develop this new study of radio astronomy, and the other important one was to continue the investigation of the high-energy cosmic rays. Mm-hmm. I must say, about a year ago, I attended a lecture here by a scientist who was doing the same thing, studying in a different technique, and the problem is still unsolved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's too late to return to it now, but because there's too much interference. But there is a really vital problem which is unsolved. That is, where do these cosmic rays of the very highest energy, where are they generated in the universe? Mm-hmm. Anyhow, that's by the way. I did have made me a pause for thought then, mm-hmm. that perhaps I had been rather foolish not to pursue that study when there was very little radio interference, and I could have used this telescope on the appropriate frequencies for studying that. Mm. Anyhow, the other subject of radio astronomy became so fascinating and important. That's how we... I then began to achieve a few research students, and including, fortunately, Henry Brown, who became very vital, and he and Hazard, with the transit telescope, discovered the radio emission from the Andromeda Nebula, M31. Mm. And this was the first real proof that the radio emission was generated in extragalactic systems, and not only in the Milky Way. Mm. So that was the beginning.
Mm. And was it an easy task building this telescope then?
I thought... The short answer is no. I can elaborate that by saying that I had a year earlier been putting enormous areas, 6-foot rotating paraboloids underneath the Lancaster bomber and flying it at 20,000 or 30,000 feet. And it seemed to me that if one could do that, it would be fairly easy to build a thing like this on the ground. But, you know, that was a tremendous error of judgment. I think in the archives you'll find a number of letters I wrote to various firms I'd been engaged with during the war. And they said what I was proposing was impossible, or that they were too busy on work of national importance. Well, as a matter of fact, it's only in recent years that I realized it almost was impossible to build that telescope at that time. Now, I had contacts with Grubb Parsons, who were big telescope builders, and in charge of that was Dr. Sisson. And I went to see him, and he came here, and he said, "Oh yes, well, we can't possibly build that telescope, but we could build the equipment to drive it for you." Then I consulted a man called Roberts. Now, Roberts had been the man from a firm called Kruger and Scruton, for whom we had bought the steel tube for the 218-foot transit telescope. And I said to Roberts, is your firm interested in tackling the, building this, what became the telescope? And he returned to his firm and consulted and said he very much regretted they didn't feel they could tackle this job. But they did know a consulting engineer who might be interested in it. And so in a day in September of 1949, that is how I met Charles Husband. And we remember standing under the transit telescope and he asked me what I wanted. And I said, well, I want an instrument at least as big as this, but probably slightly bigger, which is not fixed, but which I can steer to any part of the sky. And his reply was quite historic. He said, I said, but I'm told it's impossible. And he said, well, I said, it's not impossible. His words were about as difficult as throwing a swing bridge over the Thames at Westminster. Now, it turned out, I learned later that he had become a famous builder of bridges. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was he who was summoned to rebuild the bridge over the Menai Straits. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you say that, you see the record that it was built and redesigned by Husband. So that's how I became associated with Husband, and which after 5 or 6 tortuous years led to the event which we're celebrating now. Mm-hmm. the 50 years when we first used it to, before it was finished, incidentally, as you know.
So what was it like that year in 1957? What were the events that happened that you remember most?
Well, I'd incurred an enormous debt. In 1957, the beginning of this year, you know, all these festivities you've so kindly arranged, they sound marvellous, but it was not a marvellous year. Mm. The telescope was in very serious debt, I mean, partly my fault, but not entirely. And in 1957... I had overspent by what was then £250,000. Now, to get that into modern coinage, multiply by 20, and you get two or three million, you see. So I remember endless meetings, the people who helped finance the telescope, the Department of Scientific Research, they didn't have enough money in the beginning when I said it would cost £50,000. And it was Locke Spicer, who was the head of the DSR, said, look here, young man, I'll give you £3,000. You go away and find out how much it really will cost. Well, even then, the figure we got was £150,000 to £200,000, which was a lot of money in those days. I remember on one occasion when... Before I had this enormous debt, there was a committee inquiry came here, and the finance officer from the Government Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, the telescope was up to the top of the trunnions. There was no bowl at all. And they discussed how I'd managed to overspend all this amount of money, and you know, things were pretty gloomy. They had no more money and all that sort of thing. And And I turned to him, his name was Jolliffe, and I said, what are you going to do? And he looked, you know, I thought he said, well, we'd just stop the whole thing. Mm. And he looked out of the window, and all that he said, well, look, Lovell, the strength of your position is that huge mass of steel out there. You see? And so they went on with it. Mm-hmm. Now, at the beginning of 1957, faced with this enormous debt, and the reason for enormous debt, you can ask me about that if you want to, and I will tell you. But there was a committee of inquiry in the university, and in the face of this debt, the university themselves agreed to finance the completion of the painting of the plating of the bowl. Act of faith. Mm-hmm. I've never forgotten it. I mean, they would have had every reason for saying go. You know, you're ruining the university. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. They had faith, fortunately. And so there we are.
So go on then, explain why you overran in cost.
There was one early on, a scientific reason. The original design had an open mesh of about 4 inches, and that would have been all right for the wavelength on which I had proposed to work in those days. I mean, the wavelength on which people work nowadays, there were no means, you know, it was unheard of in those days. And there was certainly no evidence that any radio emissions existed in the very high frequency band. And then in the early 1950s, there's this remarkable discovery predicted by van der Haast in Holland, that neutral hydrogen in the universe will generate radio emissions on a wavelength of 21 centimeters. So I realized then that, you know, this would become extremely important in radio astronomy research. So I then redesigned the bowl to put in a much smaller mesh and stiffen the central 100-foot region so we could use it on this very high, very short wavelength, high frequency. Then two more things happened. In 1956, against my will, when I left the war, I simply wanted to do research, but I was not allowed to do that. The reason I wasn't very, it was very odd that Blackett had told me that if I wanted to build this telescope, I must persuade everybody in the country who knew anything about it, or all the astronomers, that it was a good thing, and particularly the Astronomers Royal. It was Sir Harold Spencer Jones at Greenwich and Greaves in Edinburgh. And so I remember, you know, Sir Harold Spencer Jones, he stayed with us, and he was a very nice fellow, and he said, oh, how very interesting. And he supported us in the famous committee in Edinburgh, decided to carry on with it. He was prominent. That was fine. But shortly afterwards, I had a letter from him. And I remember it well. Saying, Dear Lowell, I am the chairman of a Ministry of Defence committee on navigation, and we urgently need your help. What do you know? He was helping me, but I had to go. And so one thing led to another, and I've only recently come across the files, actually, in getting into the John Ryland's library. Mm-hmm. And I then on began to be, even when this telescope was being built, I was on the Aeronautical Research Council, the Air Warfare Committee, and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, on one day, a man called Coburn, who was then the scientific advisor to the Ministry of Aviation, and I'd known very well during the war. He hadn't been in my group, but he had a separate group on countermeasures. And he said, I urgently need to see you. He then had an office, which is quite close to the House of Parliament. I remember looking out of his window and seeing the Big Ben on the clock. And what he was telling me was so alarming that I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to miss my train. But I did, but there again. And his message was that the Soviets, they had information the Soviets were now advanced in the development of ballistic missiles, and they had no means of detecting them. And if I would agree to, they thought that they knew about the telescope and thought that if I made it work on a higher frequency, for which they would pay, it would be helpful. Another thing happened after the war, which you might want to ask about, but that was what happened. And so we modified the telescope and put the plate on instead of the mesh. that would have been fine, except the Treasury, or someone in the Treasury, noticed that two separate government departments were financing the same project, which was absolutely forbidden. And so we never got the money from the Ministry of Aviation. But that was not the only thing. I'd been, at that time, I'm now talking about 1956, I'd been lecturing at the National Physical Laboratory, and naturally I talked about the telescope. And after the lecture, a man called Saxton came to me and said, very interesting, Lowell. He said, have you ever heard of the Tacoma Bridge disaster? And I said, no. The Tacoma Bridge disaster over Washington State, the bridge had been built to stand all reasonable wind pressures. And many of you may have seen this astonishing film in which at quite a low wind speed, gusting, the bridge began to twist and it broke in the middle. And he said, and I said, oh, well, we're all right. We've designed the telescope to withstand wind speeds of 80 MPa. He said, yeah, but have you designed it to withstand wind speeds of 20 or 30, which are fluctuating? So I reported this to Husband, who again knew nothing about the Tacoma Bridge disaster. So he built one-tenth scale model of the telescope, and he simulated the gun racks, which rotate the elevation with springs. Now, we put this in the low-speed wind tunnel at MPL, and it was fine up to very high wind speeds. As soon as we reduced the wind speed, put in flux, shattered. You see? So then how to stop this? As you may know, the elevation is operated by electromotors driving into the 28 feet internal diameter racks from the Royal Sovereign and I think it's Revenge battleships, and this would have wrecked the teeth. So we had to put in what became a big wheel, not the one that's there now, but what's called a stabilizer girder. This operated on very large hydraulic wheels mounted on the diametrical girder of the telescope. And that is how I ended up with such an enormous debt. But you see, it sounds awful, and it was, because you might say, well, why wasn't there a committee to stop me doing these things? Well, the trouble was, nobody knew what I was doing. they did then put up a site committee, site committee under Sir Charles Reynolds, who was the chain man. And do you know, the only thing that I ever remember that committee discussing was how to get rid of the water in the bowl. it's easy now, Tim, to forget that everything was so new in those days. Mm. Yeah.